from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Across the Bay Area today and around the nation, 18-year-olds are doing something they've never done before. They're leaving home and heading off to college. The world they're about to enter will change and challenge them, starting with the choices they'll confront the first time they walk down their dormitory corridor. How much to study? How much to party? Is lifting material off the internet without attribution cheating? In the hour ahead, we'll talk about the choices new college students face today and the efforts colleges and universities are making to help their students contend with this brave new world. That's ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Going off to college has always brought new challenges and choices, but today's students confront a particularly dizzying array. What do you do when you walk into your new dorm room and your new roomie has a poster on the door supporting California's ban on gay marriage, and you happen to be gay? What do you do when you realize that many of your fellow frosh might sometimes lift material from the internet without attribution and don't consider that cheating? And what do you do about the college phenomenon known as friends with benefits, a casual sexual relationship without romantic attachments? Those are some of the dilemmas that Kirk Hansen and his colleagues try to help students with at Santa Clara University. Hansen is the executive director of the Markela Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you join us. So, what are you seeing these days that is different? Because every time a college student goes off, it seems like they're entering a brave new world. Is it braver and newer and bolder than ever before?
Well, I think this has always been an important transition in the lives of all of us, for you and myself and for our children. I think what's different today is that the kind of pressures and challenges that they're facing are much greater than perhaps they've faced in the past than you and I faced. I think also they are not, if you like, armored with some of the protections that they had in prior years, whether it be a very close relationship with their parents with a set of values at the core of that, or a religious grounding that is very strong in their lives. And as a result, many young people enter this time of college. They're dropped off this week. This is a big week for parents dropping their children off in college. And they suddenly face a set of what I think of as unavoidable challenges, predictable, unavoidable challenges that often they're not prepared to deal with.
Well, let's go through a couple of those kinds of situations that new students inevitably find themselves confronted with. I've referenced one in the introduction that was based on an example that you give and that you experienced at Santa Clara a year or so ago, which is the example of a student walking in, seeing a poster on a door that is in favor of Proposition 8, the ballot initiative that was passed by California voters in November 2008, saying that marriage could only be between a man and a woman. And someone else sees that and is offended by it and thinks that poster ought to come down because they have a completely different point of view. Mm-hmm. How do you counsel students to begin to walk through what they have a right to say? Because in the, you can make a free speech argument, mm-hmm. certainly, about that, versus what might affect the feelings of one of their fellow frosh.
Let me first say that this example and others that have come out of this project that we've conducted the last 5 years are reporting from students about what they consider to be ethical dilemmas in their freshman year. And we started this project 5 years ago by asking 10 students from 10 different universities, not just Santa Clara, but other universities here in the Bay Area and across the country, to ask their fellow students at the end of their freshman year, what were the ethical dilemmas you faced? And we got back 180 stories of really difficult dilemmas. What you hope, this is an example, I think, of a number one, a roommate problem, if it's a roommate that has this other view. And the question is, how far does tolerance go? It's also how much can you throw something in someone's face by having the poster up and confronting someone with it. What we try to do is help them understand the underlying issues. What we've done with we picked 30 cases that we thought were the most biting and representative of what college freshmen face, and we asked three students to write commentaries on them. We thought perhaps that the college students today did not want to hear from me as a 60-year-old ethics professor about ethics. They would rather hear from their own fellow students. And so you have some very thoughtful commentaries from students who have been involved in this project. The two main writers have been Deepti Shenoy and Cameron Tao, who've put together a commentary on every one of the 30. So what they tend to say in this is it is a question around tolerance, number one. Can you tolerate this other view? Are there some views that are out of bounds and that ought not to be part of what you confront others with? At the same time, there's a privacy issue, and you hope to get students to think about, okay, is there a sense of their own territory, their own privacy, their half of a room, if it's two students to a room, where they have some right to decorate it any way they want, to express any kind of political view they want, and so on.
And is there a difference, for example, in that example of whether or not the poster is in the corridor or on the outside of the door versus over someone's bed?
It seems to me that's relevant. And actually, the students who wrote about this said, be okay in the room. One of them wrote, it'd be okay in the room, but not necessarily on the outside of the door, thereby confronting everyone in the dormitory. That as long as it's a privately expressed view orally, that's fine, but you don't want to continually confront everyone else. That's one distinction.
Kirk Hansen is the executive director of the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. How do you begin then to have students prepare to contend with these sorts of questions, the poster dilemma and others that we'll talk about as we go through our hour this morning? Because you can't set them all up. You can't say, these are all of the things you're going to deal with your freshman year. You couldn't possibly. Things will come up. So how do you get people ready to face these things that will come at them?
Well, Dave, it is important to help students understand what kinds of dilemmas are inevitable. They won't necessarily be exactly as they encounter them, but much of what we do at the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara is we look at different areas of life in the United States, whether it be the college student's life or the business person's life or the doctor's life, and say, what are the ethical dilemmas you're going to face simply by having taken on that role, by the structure of that stage in your life? And I think it is a very important part of helping students anticipate and deal well with ethical issues for them to understand the kinds of dilemmas that their predecessors have faced and that simply come with having a roommate perhaps for the first time, being away from your parents, and what kind of relationship do you want with your parents? So that's an important part of the education, is you try to help them say, I'm going to have to face these. If I've thought through them in advance, I'm going to deal with them much more effectively.
How do you do that? Is that part of orientation? Do you have a requirement that everyone take a sort of how-to course in ethics? How do you begin to fold that into the 18-year-old experience?
We've experimented in a couple of ways. Orientation program at Santa Clara includes three of these situations that have to do with academic integrity. And so the question is, what are the most commonly encountered ethical dilemmas in doing your schoolwork? Well, one of them is that it's 4 a.m. and you haven't started your paper that's due at 8 a.m. and all of the temptations to download something from the internet come flooding in and, oh my gosh, I don't want to disappoint my parents and I don't want to get an F in this paper. And so the temptation is very strong to download. You want people to think about that in advance so they're less likely to succumb to the temptation. Another one is simply that you know somebody else is cheating. And what do you do? It's hurting you because there's a curve in the course and so on. And the third dilemma we find most common is that you're doing a group project and one of the three people on your team totally flakes and doesn't do their work and you're going to suffer because of it. What do you do? Do you sever that person from your team? Do you go to the professor and ask for traditional time. What's the fair way of handling that?
And the last one also connects up to something that is different in terms of the digital age, because now study groups can take place online. You could have someone that's just sort of lurking online, getting all of the benefit of other people's thinking and utilizing it that way. So let's talk a little bit about how the digital age makes some of these ethical choices different. There was a story in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about plagiarism in particular. And one of the statistics in it that I found sort of sobering was that in this one survey of 14,000 college students, only 29% thought that copying something from the web without attribution constituted real cheating. Is that what you're finding as well, that the notion of appropriating from different sources is now considered sort of the norm?
I think there's an educational part of this process of helping students prepare to handle the unavoidable dilemmas as well. Many of them simply don't understand what is plagiarism and what is not. And what we're finding is that professors need to put in their syllabus exactly what kind of collaboration is permitted or what kind of downloading is permitted from the internet. There has to be education at the beginning of your whole college years as well, some basic education in plagiarism. But this is a complex world. And whereas you and I would go to get the card catalog, get the book, write down a quote from it, there's the downloading of quotes, and the line gets blurred in many students' minds between the downloading of quotes and the downloading of more extensive pieces for a paper.
One of the things that's interesting about that, I think, in some of the articles that I've read on this topic, is just a basic difference perhaps in how today's college students see identity and authorship. They're used to a world of trying out different personas. They're used to a world where music is often done as combinations, as mashups. And this idea of sort of bringing in this, bringing in that, you know, extrapolating this from that and incorporating it into something new conveys a different sense of what sort of ownership and authorship really means. Is that what you're finding?
Well, here I've taught in business schools now for 35 years, and we've taught people that teamwork is the very core skill for the future. And so this concept of collaboration is one we celebrate as a society. And for the younger students, it's hard for them to make these kinds of distinctions between this encouragement to be collaborative and to share the work, and at the same time being able to show some sense of your own work and the integrity of having your own work. I think there's an educational process that has to take place in order to help them see those distinctions. But clearly, we want to encourage collaboration. And with all of the resources available on the internet, all of our intellectual products from here forward are going to be drawn from many more sources than we were drawing from in writing college papers 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago.
And again, how do you begin to start that educational process? Is it as simple as a professor saying on the first day of class, here's what's kosher and here's what's not?
I think it's a continuing education process. Hopefully, you do something in orientation, you do something in the college policies towards this, and then you have each professor who reinforces that by the particular rules. Perhaps there's a paper that's a collaborative paper, and maybe there's another paper that's an individual effort paper. And that's got to be very clear. And professors fail in their responsibility, their ethical responsibility, if they aren't very clear about that expectation.
How widespread a conversation is this among you and your colleagues across universities and colleges around the country? Is this something that everyone is wrestling with? Have people figured out sort of new approaches? What's the kind of current level of interaction on this question around the country?
This is an agenda item for every dean of freshmen, for every dean of students in every university in the country. How do we help the students manage their lives and make ethical choices, life choices, in a way that, number one, they don't damage themselves, whether it be alcohol or drugs or sex in the first couple of years of college. Secondly, that they build a philosophy of life and a sense of who they are, what their values are, and universities have always had that agenda. Ethics education has always been at the core of the purpose of a college and a university. But now it's much more difficult and therefore is a much bigger agenda item for all of these professionals who are in the field of student affairs and student life. I think they're seeking one of the things. We've had a very good collaboration at Santa Clara with Jeannie Rosenberger, who's the head of student life at Santa Clara, as we have explored these issues over the last 5 years. Our challenge now, exactly as you say, is how to take this learning about what the dilemmas are, what the nature of these choices are, and communicate them to not just Santa Clara's incoming freshmen, but also to communicate them much more broadly. How do we make this material available to every entering college student in the country? It's probably not a traditional book. Maybe it's a website. Maybe it's an interactive place where the college freshmen themselves can come get advice from each other, as perhaps maybe from an ethicist occasionally, and also can post their dilemmas, which are somewhat different. We noticed just in the 5 years of this project that the dilemmas have changed a bit. Hmm. And so one of the dilemmas that's in the project now that wasn't 5 years ago is, what are the ethics of unfriending someone or of choosing who to friend in the first place on Facebook? And when do you give offense? When do you have a responsibility to friend, and so on?
Does this, in essence, become just asking questions we all ask ourselves in life about sort of who am I? Who do I want to be? What am I here for? How do I want others to treat me? I mean, they're really basic core questions, aren't they?
They are. And ethics is simply about that. Ethics is about, what kind of a person do I want to be? What values do I want to live by? And often, unfortunately, our college students don't have a strong grounding in that when they show up on orientation day. But they are faced with trying to work that out for themselves. And they're trying to work it out in a world which often gives them a lot of conflicting messages about what's worthwhile. Is getting wealthy the only objective in life? Is service to your fellow human being the primary purpose? And they're trying to work that out. That's our center is called Applied Ethics, the Markle Center for Applied Ethics. Applied Ethics is about living out one's values in the various roles and professions that we take on in our lives.
Let's take up another example, which was one of the ones when I was reading about the examples that you're dealing with that was a bit of an eye-opener to me, I confess, and that was called something called Friends with Benefits. You want to describe what that is, Kirk Hansen?
Well, one of the most interesting and challenging things in dealing with ethics in the college years is sex, as one might imagine. It was back in the 60s when I went to college, but it's even more complex today. And one of the phenomena that we've dealt with is the concept of friends with benefits and the casual sexual hookups, as they're also known, although I understand that hookups term has now had its half-life of a couple of years and is beginning to fade. But the concept is that casual sex is okay and that one has partners with whom one has casual sex. They're friends with the sexual benefits. Now, that raises all kinds of difficult questions about, do you and I mean the same thing by sex? And what we found is that some of the damage done by those arrangements is because one person thinks of sex very casually and the other person thinks of it in much more permanent and profound terms.
So let's say I'm an 18-year-old and I'm involved in that sort of relationship, a friends with benefit relationships, but I'm starting to not feel perhaps completely fine about that. Mm-hmm. Come in and talk to someone at a center like yours. What do you begin to walk through? What is it that you want students to ask of themselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, the job of ethics education on any college campus is difficult because if you're too strong in communicating the norms that you think are appropriate, the students are going to walk away and are going to disregard your perspectives completely. This is the problem of every administrator in a university. You come on too strong.
And every parent.
And every parent, exactly. And so I think our first attempt, and we do a series of discussions all year long with students about these dilemmas at noontime, in the evening over dessert, and so on. What we try to communicate is, number one, hey, this is a legitimate problem you are going to face, and we try to give two perspectives, frankly. One, a much more conservative perspective, if you want to call it that, or I would call it one grounded very firmly in ethics, and will say, here's an approach which is much more respectful of the other human beings, that you ought not ever to get into a relationship without making sure that particularly something as powerful as sex is understood in the same way by the other person. And you might consider not getting engaged in it at all. We also will generally have someone on the panel who will be more liberal. But our hope is that we legitimate having either a more conservative or ethical perspective. Very often the students tell us, gosh, I thought everybody was doing it. I thought everybody was having sex. I thought everybody was cheating. I thought everybody was taking drugs and getting drunk on Saturday night. That isn't true.
Have you found that there's a particular question that gets students thinking about what's helpful to them? In other words, Is it asking them, how do you want to be viewed? Is it asking them to think about how they'll feel about this, you know, later? Have you found a way that helps students begin to sort of begin that kind of ethical self-inquiry?
I think you first have to get them to see that this is really their lives. Many of them are still rebelling against their parents or feeling that the power is elsewhere. And so you want them to see that this is their choice of how they're going to live their life. And so you try to give them some sense that this is their agenda. And then you hopefully can say to them and have it be credible, the choices you make today influence your character tomorrow. So the choices you make now in your freshman year or in your sophomore year, in your junior or senior year, will influence how you behave when you're out in the business world or out in the world thereafter. The kinds of choices you make today about sexual morality will influence the quality of your romantic and sexual relationships 5 years from now and 10 years from now.
Santa Clara is a Jesuit university.
Yes, it is.
Obviously has a grounding and connection to one particular faith tradition. Do you find students who come to Santa Clara that presents its own series of questions and obstacles? In other words, that's a time when people often question not only their allegiance to faith, but allegiance to any number of things. That while you'd think Santa Clara might be a place where there's sort of a firmer bedrock of particular values or traditions, that in itself provides a kind of challenge to people who aren't so sure that that's where they want to be affiliated anymore.
Well, for every college student there is, or the typical college student often chooses to rebel against their religious upbringing. And it's no different at Santa Clara than it is anywhere else. The percentage of students who go to services weekly declines during the college years, and then a junior, senior year and thereafter tends to come back up. But the first 2 or 3 years of college is a tough time. For a Catholic and Jesuit university, a school with those kinds of traditions, we feel we have an obligation and a special opportunity to describe the values that come out of that Catholic and Jesuit culture and belief system and so on. But our students are probably about 55% Catholic, 50 to 55. And so we have a very diverse student body. We want that belief system to be a strength without communicating that others are not welcome. And so at least in my experience, for example, on the staff of the Markle Center for Applied Ethics, we have people of many different religious backgrounds and not religious backgrounds, and yet they're all just as much committed to ethics.
Kirk Hansen, he's the executive director of the Markle Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we want to open up our phone lines to your questions and thoughts about this. If you're heading off to college right now, what are some of the concerns you have? If you're already in college, what are some of the tough dilemmas you've faced and how have you dealt with them? And if you're a parent of a college student or an 18-year-old, what are you most concerned about in terms of what your students will face as they head off to college this week and in the weeks ahead? Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Back with more with Kirk Hansen in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Kirk Hansen is our guest this hour. He's a professor at Santa Clara University and executive director of Santa Clara University's Markkula Center for Applied Ethics. Our topic this hour, what you contend with when you're going off to college for the first time, the kind of ethical choices and dilemmas from dealing with roommates to dealing with cheating to partying to parents. How do you sort through all of those things when you're off at college for the first time? We welcome your thoughts and questions about that. If you're a college student, what are you wrestling right now with that's particularly challenging? Or how have you come to terms with something in a way that you feel good about? We'd welcome your participation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Add your comments online and we'll get those into our conversation as well. Let's go to Judy first in Mountain View. Judy, go ahead.
Hi. I think this is a fabulous subject to be pursuing. But what I would really think is excellent would be to have mandatory discussion groups with, say, a graduate student, but that it would be, you know, like a class for freshmen, because these are subjects that many of the freshmen will not have spent much time thinking about.
Judy, thanks.
I think, Judy, you're exactly on target. One of my hopes for this project, this has been shepherded by two of my colleagues, Miriam Schulman and David DeCosse, and what they've done is to put all this material together. They've got it ready for us to try to take out in a variety of forms. I hope that by putting some of this online, it can encourage other universities and Santa Clara to do a more extensive job of leading students through all of these dilemmas. Because I would argue that this set of 30 that we've focused on, students are going to face almost all of them in their first couple of years of college. And I do think they'll handle them better if they've thought through them in advance.
What about advice to parents, Kirk Hansen? What about mandatory conversations with parents?
I've given a number of talks over the last couple of years about this project to parents groups. I find a couple of reactions. One is horror that there are these ethical dilemmas that their students have to confront, and perhaps even an unrealistic expectation that a college can somehow remove all ethical problems from the college experience. They're certainly there inevitably, in my view. A college can do a lot to support the students, to educate the students, and so on. But the parents clearly need to be aware of these dilemmas as well, because they can be supportive. And when a student, when one of their children says, oh my gosh, I'm having this kind of problem with my roommate, they need to be able to help the student talk it through. I think they've got to resist being a helicopter parent or somehow want to solve the problem for the student. This is a part of growing up, is learning to solve these dilemmas for themselves. But I think they can be real help in helping their child talk through, think through in a reasonable way these dilemmas.
You mentioned the helicopter parent phenomenon, the idea of parents who are always hovering. There was a story I read the other day now about how colleges have to act aggressively to get parents off campus, that they don't want to leave. Don't want to leave their precious 18-year-old, and that you part of what going to college means is that separation.
And I think that's a very good development. When my three children have gone to college, in each of the colleges that they've gone to, there's been a ceremonial moment at which this is your time to say goodbye to your child, i.e., and it's time for you to leave. And I think what that does is it reinforces for the parent their role in this, which is not to be hovering, but to be supportive, to be available.
But would you also advise, Kirk Hansen, that before this moment that students are now engaged in and parents are engaged in this week of heading off to college, that you have conversations, that you say, you know, one of the things you're going to probably contend with, if you haven't already in high school, is this idea of friends with benefits, mm-hmm. of having casual sexual relationship mm-hmm. between friends where you have sex but you don't have a romantic mm-hmm. attachment. That's something that's going to come up. I mean, should parents have that sort of direct conversation?
Oh, I think definitely. I think with my children, maybe because I'm in the midst of all of this applied ethics and practical ethics kinds of questions. We talked about many of these 30 issues prior to their entering college. And I think with something like sex, what you want to do is communicate your values. There is nothing wrong with parents communicating their values and explaining why they believe in romantic love, having a certain characteristic, sex having a certain meaning, or what tolerance means and what you can tolerate and what you can't. I think that's a very important role, a values education role on the part of parents. It isn't a do it or else. The one thing I don't want you to do is to have sex or to do whatever.
Go to our next caller, Bobby in Sacramento. Bobby, go ahead.
Hi. I'm a recent college graduate, and I feel like those casual hookups were actually a big part of my college experience and me finding out who I was. And I'm wondering, because it's a Jesuit university, there's a religious tag associated with does that play a role in your center and the values and beliefs that you guys push, i.e. abstinence or, you know, no sex until marriage?
Bobby, stay with us. I have a follow-up question I want to ask you, but Kirk Hansen, go ahead.
I think there are a variety of views on the Santa Clara campus, just as there would be at Berkeley or Davis or wherever. I think there's clearly a strong belief in the sanctity of marriage and in the importance of the intimacy of sexual relationships. On the other hand, there are faculty and students who feel very differently from that. I'm not sure that I have a good handle on what the actual incidence of sexual behavior is at a Catholic Jesuit university versus a Berkeley or a Davis or a Santa Cruz. But my guess is it's probably pretty similar. And I think we're in a different era than when I was in college, and I recognize that. I think parents have to recognize that. But at the same time, you shouldn't be hesitant to communicate your own values. But you also need to know that the students are going to make their own choices.
Bobby, I was interested in what you said leading up to your question to Kirk Hansen about how those casual hookups, as they're sometimes referred to in college, were a big part of your college experience and discovering who you were. If you don't mind, can you say more about that? What did you learn about yourself in that way? Because I think a lot of parents in particular would probably be interested in hearing your answer.
Definitely. I mean, it's a trial by error system. You know, it's being curious about something and going after it, and then having conversations with your peers afterwards or your mentors, you know, your advisors, and really reflecting back on that experience, which probably doesn't happen enough. And that's why I'm really interested in the center that they're having at Santa Clara, is because of that reflection piece.
Mm-hmm. And we're having a bit of trouble with your connection, Bobby. I don't know if you have a radio on in the background. If you can, dial that down a notch. But just one last thought, and we'll let you go. When you say that you learned a lot, what did you learn? Did you learn something about sort of how you view yourself and how you view others?
Most definitely. It's not that I necessarily want those kind of relationships throughout my life. And I realize that I do want to be in a monogamous relationship, but it's not necessarily that I want to be down right now. And I learned that by not necessarily being stuck in a monogamous relationship in my 18 to early 20s, seeing that those are values that I do have, just not right now.
Bobby, thanks. Thanks for sharing your story with us. It's helpful and intriguing to hear. Thanks for being part of our program. Kirk Hansen, reactions to what Bobby had to say?
Well, I think it's part of every student's life. It certainly was a part of my life of trying on different identities and experimenting and so on. I remember getting drunk the first time. It wasn't a pleasant experience, and so I tended not to imbibe of alcohol much after that point during my college years. I think there is a sense today that perhaps drinking goes further to binge drinking than the kind of experimentation a number of years ago. The casualness of sex goes further than it did in a prior generation. There's two ways to take that. One is that that's simply the way things are today. The other is to frankly communicate to your students. You know, that's not my sense of what is the healthiest in the long term and the most respectful of your partner. What I hope people like Bobby do once they've had an intimate relationship is that they talk not just to their peers, but they talk to the person that they've had the relationship with, because there are a set of experiences on the other side that they need to understand. How is this, if you're a man, how is this for the woman? Or if you're a woman, how is this for the man?
So Bobby may have learned certain things, but it'd be good to hear what the other person in the relationship learned as well.
What we've seen too often is that the two people find the sexual encounter to mean very different things.
Kirk Hansen, again, our guest. He's the executive director of the Markla Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. We welcome your calls if you'd like to phone in and talk about your own experiences in college or what you're contending with, either as a college student or as a parent. You're welcome to do so at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. To some of our emails, Rebecca writes in, "It's unbelievable to me that someone 18 years of age does not know the definition of plagiarism. It's an incredibly simple concept. Any idea that is not yours needs to be cited. Referencing a reliable source should be a good thing. It shows that the author took the time to research a subject and has published material to back up his or her ideas."
I wish every student were as clear as Rebecca is about that. What we find is that there is a lot of confusion, and but we need to do the kind of educational job that leads to the clarity that she expresses.
One article I read made a really interesting point about this, and that again speaks to the perhaps change in our digital society, that when people used to go to the library and pull a book out of the shelf, you had a more tactile sense of words. You had a firmer sense of where the source actually came from, because it was something you held. Mm-hmm. And that's changed now, because it comes in at every direction, mm-hmm. and it's much more amorphous.
I think that's true. And the sources that you're citing are not just books that you pull off the stacks, the shelves of a library, but they're blogs, they're informal comments, there's Wikipedia. Most professors I know now have an explicit statement in their syllabus that Wikipedia references are not permitted or lead to a decline in the grade rather than some credit. But I think there is a lot of confusion. There's a lot of assembling of points from internet sources that is very different than the kind of scholarship we did in the past. But you've got to get students to be clear that what we want is individual work, individual effort, individual creativity. And if they have that basic theme in mind, they're going to get to the kind of specific conclusions that Rebecca was encouraging.
Joe writes in, "Ethics issues need to be a two-way street with students and professors. Professors need to assign group projects with the knowledge that a good portion of the students won't do anything to assist their group. This means grading accordingly and offering extra time for office hours. As a recent college graduate, I can tell you that cheating everywhere is rampant. If the other people in your class are cheating and not getting caught and getting better grades than you, what are you supposed to do?"
I think ethics is a responsibility of every role, and clearly it's not just the students, the faculty, and there's actually a number of efforts to define ethics codes for faculty, not just on the individual campuses, but nationally, and ethics codes for administrators of universities. And often, an incident of academic integrity, a plagiarism incident, can be traced back to the failure of the professor to give enough time to explain it, sometimes to be available to answer questions about what kinds of collaboration, for example, are permitted, or the lack of care in how they conduct examinations. The classic case is the professor who gives the same final exam for the fourth year in a row or cycles them every other year.
And what about Joe's other point that, as he puts it, if other people are cheating, not getting caught, and getting good grades than you are, how do you contend with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are two answers to that. One is the university clearly should have some kind of a campaign, a set of procedures in which they're trying to increase the level of integrity in academic work and talking about how important that is. That said, there will always be cases where you will be aware that somebody else is cheating. All of us who've worked in business know that we run across cases where there are other people are somehow taking advantage or cheating.
And
it's a part of life. And we have to decide, each of us individually has to decide whether when confronted with that, we decide we're going to level the playing field by cheating too, or whether it's worth it somehow to our sense of who we are to resist that even under those conditions.
So it comes back to that central question there. You have to ask yourself, who do I want to be? How do I want to look at myself now and in the future?
One of the hardest things to get across to young people in general is that happiness in life is much more related to how comfortable you are with the choices you made than it is whether you achieve a certain level of wealth, a certain set of prizes, a certain admission to a graduate school. The most important thing is how you feel you've lived your life.
And back to our calls. Justin in Gilroy is next. Justin, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I teach high school and I teach college prep courses for social studies. And I was wondering, just what do you think high school teachers should do to help, I guess, entering college freshmen with these questions, I guess?
Well, I think there are a number of answers. One is clearly character education in general has to be much more of a theme in public education and private education K through 12. We have quite an extensive character education program at the Markla Center run by Steve Johnson, who's worked with now, I think, 40 or 42 of California's 58 county school superintendents to help introduce character education into the K through 12 experience. But more specifically, I think those last couple of years, the junior and senior years in high school, should be a time in which these dilemmas and others start to be raised, because that's where you've got your first experiences without, well, maybe not your first experiences with alcohol, but people are facing many of these issues already in high school that they're going to face full-blown in college.
Justin, thanks for the call, and perhaps even sooner than Justin's high school students. I mean,
yes.
After all, kids are using computers in the early primary
yes.
grades now, and so you also have the phenomenon, at least it seems to me from conversations that I have with parents, of parents hyper-engaged with their mm-hmm. kids in doing their schoolwork with them, so the parents are sort of party to contributing work that isn't necessarily the students too, and that can start at quite an early age.
Unfortunately, the temptations for both the student and the parents to engage in cheating are higher than they've ever been. There's the perception is that if you don't get into certain colleges or you don't get certain awards, you don't get to be a major in this particular department, that your life is ruined. And, of course, that's hogwash. There are many paths to a fulfilling life. But that's the perception. And, you know, my favorite story was the one you perhaps read about as well in a national story recently, which was that a student was hauled up for plagiarism in college. And took his father when he went in to see the dean and to get his penalty. And the father admitted he'd actually written the paper and plagiarized.
To Adrian in San Jose. Adrian, go ahead. You're on.
Hi there.
Yes, you're on the air, Adrian. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I graduated from college like 10 years ago, and I went to the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California, and I remember in our freshman year, we took a class on ethics called Mentor, and we learned about all of these things that you've been talking about, and it was really helpful for me.
Great.
Adrian, thanks.
I've not been aware of that, and I will look into it right after the program. That's a great example.
Adrian, thanks for the call and for sharing that experience at the University of the Pacific. Maya writes in, I have two questions. First, how do you deal with people who don't pay their share when you go out to dinner? And second, how do you deal with boring or unpleasant people you don't want to hang out with?
Oh, those are wonderful lessons to learn in college. You learn very quickly as students go out for pizza or students go out to a movie or whatever, that there are people who are cheap and who don't pay their fair share.
So and what do you say?
That's a really important lesson. Well, the first thing you learn is to be assertive enough to challenge that. And you may also have to say, you know, maybe we won't go out to dinner again together, or we won't go out for a movie.
But that's not an easy thing for
a
60-year-old to do, let alone a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how do you get people to be comfortable enough to say something that's I mean, that's a hard thing to do, Kirk Hansen.
Generally, what we encourage people to do is to say how it affects you. Mm-hmm. And so you want to say, you know, it's really uncomfortable to me that the last two times you haven't put any money in for this pizza. And, you know, I'd sure like for you to carry your fair share. And then you go on for a couple more times out for pizza. And if the person still doesn't do it, then, you know, you've got to be a little more assertive. And you've got to say, hey, you know, my values are and my expectation is that we're all in this together. And if we're not, then, you know, I don't feel we're very good friends.
And Maya's other question about what if you don't want to hang out with someone who you think is sort of boring?
Well, I think that that's related to the question about who do you friend on Facebook. There are some people you don't want to friend. There are some people you don't want to hang out with. I think the values that ought to inform that are first respect. From an ethics standpoint, the key thing is to respect everyone that you deal with. It isn't a matter of just saying, like the mean girls in the movie, ooh, I don't want to deal with you. But it's being respectful of someone who's different than you or who you don't want to spend time with, and perhaps to find a happy median that says, okay, I'll chat with this person over breakfast, but maybe I won't go out to dinner off campus with them.
Back to our calls. Lisa is next in Oakland. Lisa, go ahead, please.
First, I wanted to say I really appreciate this conversation. It's really thought-provoking, and I'm a recent college graduate. And something, I believe it was Bobby that called in, but something that I feel was lacking in my college experience was something in terms of what I live by my own life was that students sort of had this aimless direction. And I recently read an article in the New York Times about this concept of emerging adulthood. And I feel like students have lost the notion that they can discipline themselves. And so in Bobby's example, he says he went outside of himself to learn more about what he wanted. And I feel like nowadays that's sort of an easy out for students is avoiding the self-discipline of what I feel, you know, my parents raised me in this way and I'm not uber conservative or uber religious. But I just feel like self-discipline is something that's lacking with students nowadays because there's, you know, we're bombarded with too many choices or we feel that we don't need to have self-discipline because life is our oyster, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Lisa, no, thank you. Stay with us. I want to hear what Kirk Hansen has to say.
Oh, I think your point is very well taken, both about the many greater choices that people have to face. I think today the range of behaviors and the range of styles of life are so much greater than ever in the past. And students, in some ways, have a right to think my parents don't understand me because they didn't have all these choices or they don't understand them. The troubling thing about the 20s emerging as a time of continued search or aimless exploration of life is that I think it's a poor preparation for the kind of adult commitment one hopes one reaches eventually. It's bad enough to think about college as being a completely undisciplined time in which anything goes. But if you extend that into the 20s, you know, you're starting to develop a pattern of life. And so we go back to the fundamental question that Dave and I talked about at the beginning. This ethics stuff is really about what kind of a person do I want to be? And it isn't, you can't lead a totally undisciplined life for 4 years, for 12 years, and then suddenly turn around and say, now I'm going to be mature or now I'm going to be something different.
Lisa, just a quick follow-up. Was there a particular moment or point where you came to where you were able to ask yourself, well, this is who I want to be? Was there a kind of aha moment in that process for you?
Well, I think similar to what Kurt touched upon briefly just before about, you know, and not in terms of right or wrong, but what can you live with in life and what is healthiest for you in the long run? You know, happiness isn't about money, but it's about reflecting on the choices you've made and being okay with them. And so I think in college, experiencing these things like getting drunk or maybe, you know, sleeping with someone or hooking up with someone when, you know, it was very casual. And I realized those weren't rewarding for me. And I thought, why is everyone saying I need to experiment or I need to have this to understand myself, when I could understand myself without having to do that?
Lisa, thanks. Thanks for being part of our program.
Very,
really appreciate
very profound
your,
thought.
Your point of view. Let's get in a couple more thoughts, if we can, in our few remaining moments. Jefferson in Oakland is up next. Jefferson, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Okay, so my question, it's more, you said, what kind of a person do I want to be in terms of what ethics are?
Yes.
That this is the kind of question that you're taking on. But my curiosity is to, the values that develop from 0 to 18 years of age and how they live mentally, but they also live emotionally and go into things like the subconscious. And you're addressing them now at this point at a level that's essentially mental when so much may live underneath in the subconscious.
Let me respond if I can. There's been a feeling everything I ever needed to learn I learned in kindergarten, and it's all over by the end of kindergarten. And those of us who teach ethics at the college level, the graduate school level, and most of my life I've been teaching it in executive programs, I think have come to realize that ethics is constantly formed. My values are my character today is a result of my character when I started yesterday and my experiences and my commitments and my choices yesterday. And my character tomorrow will be shaped by those choices today. And as a result, I think even though exactly as you say, we carry with us a set of values, a set of emotional strengths and weaknesses and so on that is formed throughout our first 18 years, the college years are still a very critical time away from our families often, in which we're making some of these fundamental choices for the first time without our parents hovering over us. And therefore, it's a really, really important time.
Just one last question I want to squeeze in here from Heidi, who says, I'm really enjoying the conversation, and I think Professor Hansen sounds like a really, really nice man. But I'm wondering if he's a little out of touch. The statement that it's harder for college students these days than in former years doesn't exactly ring true to me. And then Heidi goes on to describe the kind of challenges she faced in the college years in the 80s and says, you know, after all, doesn't the internet make people even more aware of diverse points of view? Isn't that something that actually brings in new ways of thinking to today's college students?
I think the point is well taken, Heidi. The challenges that were faced in the 60s, where there was a complete break perhaps from many of the values before that and the rebellious generation, or the values in the 80s and the turmoil then, or the turmoil in the last few years. Each of those is a unique environment in which that generation shapes its values. And so, you know, each of them is unique and perhaps just as pressured. I think the internet brings us a knowledge about the world and perhaps, I think, a belief that we have to be tolerant, and tolerance becomes a much more important value to think about today.
We're out of time, but let's say you're putting your college student off to college today, and as you're walking away from him or her, as they walk into their dormitory for the first time, what are the last words you want to say to that child?
Well, I've done this three times in the last 6 years, and I think it is make good choices, don't take excessive risks, and I'm always there for you.
Kirk Hansen, the Executive Director of the Markela Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Dave.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today, Howard Gelman. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Monday morning on Forum with Michael Krasny, the topic in the first hour will be the U.S. pullout from Iraq. Where are we with that and where will that go from here? And then in the second hour, Michael's guest is the physician and author Dean Ornish. That's coming up Monday morning on Forum with Michael Krasny. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.